Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine, analyze, and discuss various issues and events that shape, challenge, and sometimes disrupt our daily lives. Young people today are growing up in a world that feels anything but stable. A global pandemic, disrupted school, friends, and routines, political polarization, and social unrest dominate headlines. Wars, economic instability, and climate change create a constant backdrop of uncertainty. And at the same time, many teens and young adults struggle to access timely, affordable mental health care. So, how are young folks really doing, and what tools can help them manage stress, emotions, and the overload of modern life? Dr. Kathy Wu, author of the Self-Regulation Handbook for Teens and Young Adults. It's a trauma-informed guide to fostering personal resilience and enhancing personal skills. Dr. Wu offers us a roadmap for navigating anxiety, depression, anger, loneliness, grief, political fatigue, and more. Today, she joins 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, and Dr. Wu, I welcome you to 411 Teen.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for our conversation today.
I am too. From your clinical and research perspective, how would you describe the overall mental and emotional health of teens and young adults right now?
I just can't help but just shake my head in disbelief the amount of burden that our generation is undergoing right now, our generation of teens and young adults, particularly Generation Z. What we know is that from recent studies, 42% of Gen Z individuals have been diagnosed with a mental health condition, with anxiety being the most common, followed by depression, ADHD, PTSD, and approximately 20% have attended therapy, and 60% are on medication to manage their mental health challenges. So it is just an immensely pressing time to get mental health care in the hands of our generation right now. And just the sheer volume of things that are just piling on. And I thought I had it bad as a millennial, but I'm so sorry, Gen Zers, you are having it really bad right now.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree with you. When we talk about the populations today, how do Gen Z and Gen Alpha differ from previous generations, particularly in looking at their stressors that they face? Because often, you know, when I talk with parents, they don't recognize the impact of today's stressors. So if you would share that, I think that would be very beneficial when we look at the stressors that they face today that are just overwhelming compared to what were faced 15, 20 years ago even.
Yeah. The most recent statistic that I can bring forth is that about 27% of Gen Zers are reporting fair or poor mental health, which is nearly double the percentage presented by millennials. And what we also know is that about 90-some percent experience at least one symptom of stress, such as feeling sad, depressed, or lacking interest in activities. So it's really a reflection of where we are right now with climate change, economic stress, political fatigue, and political I don't know how to describe it.
You lose, there's a loss of words. I mean, the impact is so severe. And so far reaching that it's hard for you to even, you know, put it in words. I mean, I'm glad I don't have a Gen Zer at this point, you know, that I'm raising, or I don't have any children at all, that mine are all out of the house, because this is horrible. It's a horrible time to be growing up, if you ask me. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of technology and a lot of advances, but there's a hell of a lot of stressors that they have no control over. None.
Absolutely none. And that's the part that I really want to convey to the generation, that so much of this is outside of your hands. And so the choices are one of two, right? So one is to shore yourself up as much as you can for the level of turbulence that we're all having to be subjected to. And two is to give in. And I don't think that's the right answer, particularly since you have your whole life ahead of you. We want to be able to make sure that you are going to be okay for the long haul.
And I know you get this all the time, but we can't help but address it. What impact did COVID-19 have that we still are underestimating? Because I don't think that everyday folks have an appreciation for how COVID-19 totally topsy-turvy their lives.
Yeah, it's really still, the effects are still yet to be determined. Mm-hmm. But from what I have seen, even in the therapeutic context, just those who have actually been able to sign up for therapy, is that there is this sense of isolation that they experience from that of from other the sense of isolation and loneliness. I think it's really key, mm-hmm. in the sense that their experiences are not exactly being related to by people outside of their generation. I think that there is this overarching, detachment from what it feels to be socially connected. And I think due to COVID-19, that was just incredibly hard to really understand how to manage when individuals were experiencing that level of detachment. It's really hard to really understand what the long-term effects of that right now. Mm. But I think, you know, bringing everything from, just offline to online has really had a huge impact in our generation's capacity to feel connected to the outside world and to others in particular.
Well, many young people struggle to access therapy or psychiatric care. We know that is a major issue. I mean, with 42% of them, you know, having anxiety, and what was it, about 20% are actually in therapy?
Yeah.
Would you share the gaps that you see most? What's going on? Where are the gaps there?
The gaps in terms of the capacity to access?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think health insurance, the cost is a real, true, concrete barrier to accessing. But I think there's still relative amount of stigma associated with seeking help and support from others. I know that in this generation, we have seen a great deal of open concepts, open conversation rather, around mental health and awareness more than other generations before them. But there is still a great deal of this idea that I have to go at it alone, or mm-hmm. my feelings, my emotions, and my general well-being isn't at the level where it requires professional contribution or professional mm-hmm. alliances rather. So I think that what is really getting in the way is just this recognition that that there is something to be helped, or there is something that requires some co-regulation on behalf of a therapist or a mental health professional.
What role can, do you think that self-guided tools really realistically play? And what are their limits? And this was the question that when I talked with a parent and told them I was talking with you, that they had asked me to particularly express to you.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to self-regulation or self-access tools, mm-hmm. it does require the individual to feel that there is a need, okay. right? And to have mm-hmm. that acknowledgement. And sometimes we have a hard time being able to see that our problems are actually burdening us, or that it is at the it's rising to the level by which we need to intervene. And so having that self-awareness can be either a point by which we catalyze for seeking support, or not having it can sometimes limit us from being able to do something on our own. But I have to say, this book that that just came out is one that I'm having a hard time really being able to get some direct feedback from teenagers okay. on. I'm not sure if they're actually reading it. Their parents certainly are.
Yeah, yeah.
That part of it is because so much of the information that's being gathered, it's through more visual media as opposed to picking up a book. And so there is a trend towards, you know, pulling up YouTube to access information, or Instagram, as opposed to the traditional model of a book. So that's something that I am more aware of. And I'm trying to find ways to maybe translate some of the information that I have in the book into more accessible media.
Well, I want to say I felt the book was written to, I should say, teens and young adults. And many books of this ilk are written about them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? And I saw that as being a real positive about your book, in that, hey, we're not going to talk about you. We're mm-hmm. going to talk to you.
Okay. Yeah, with you.
And with you. Yeah, yeah. And I saw that as a real, real positive. It's about time that we get ready to take a break. But when we come back from the break, I would like to talk more about your book. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm talking with Dr. Kathy Wu. She is the author of The Self-Regulation Handbook for Teens and Young Adults. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I would like to reintroduce my guest, Dr. Kathy Wu. She is the author of Self-Regulation Handbook for Teens and Young Adults. Dr. Wu, I want to talk to you just a little bit about your title. And you were saying you weren't sure if teens and young folks were really reading it. Self-regulation can sound a bit intimidating and overwhelming, especially, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody's already struggling. Why did you choose that term? I think it's great. Don't get me wrong. But I just want you to share why you chose that term.
Yeah, I know it sounds like it's a very intimidating concept and a mm-hmm. complex concept, but I wanted to really highlight this idea that your capacity to live a happy, healthy, well-adjusted life is within your control. So I really wanted to emphasize the self part. Mm-hmm. And yes, the regulation sounds a little bit mechanical and clinical, but it's really about noticing what's inside you, your thoughts, emotions, and your body, and then responding in a way that supports you, right? So mm-hmm. instead of reacting automatically, it's about you and centering you. And then thought that was important to be able to really tune into, because while a therapist, a parent, a teacher can be really helpful, it's ultimately up to you to decide how you want to navigate our world and all the emotions and all the complexities that come with it.
Okay. let's get into the book. Talk about and define self-regulation. And talk about it in a way that feels attainable for those who are listening, so parents can understand it, maybe teens can get a better grasp for exactly where you're coming from. What mm-hmm. is self-regulation?
Okay, so the way I define self-regulation is the ability to manage your emotions, thoughts, and behaviors in ways that help you stay calm, focused, and in control, especially during challenging situations. So for example, self-regulation helps when you are needing to stay patient when you're frustrated. Resist maybe saying something you might really regret later. Mm-hmm. Staying on task when you're really distracted. Or making thoughtful choices instead of acting just on gut, right? And it's like having a bit of like an inner remote control, so to speak, that helps you pause, think, and respond in healthy ways rather than acting on every feeling or impulse right away. And as a teen, we understand that there's a lot of impulses and a lot of big feelings, but it's really giving you that backseat type of sense of control over what it is that's happening in front of you. So self-regulation is really a skill that develops over time. It's not something you have or you don't. It's a progressive and developmental process. And everyone can strengthen it with practice, support, and self-awareness.
Does one need to go to a professional or be in the care of a professional to achieve self-regulation?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I always say that my job as a therapist is to not be as important to you. In fact, it's about me being obsolete, rather, right, to your mm-hmm. life, so that you begin to develop and have a sense as to what to do when things become challenging. And so my hope is that because there is not as much accessibility to therapy in this kind of formal format, that you have a guide that helps you get started. And then over time, you begin to grow your sea legs, so to speak, and become mm-hmm. stronger and stronger and more easily able to access your coping mechanisms. So I don't think, I all the therapists out there will probably not appreciate me saying this, right? But I don't think you absolutely need to have weekly therapy sessions in order to mm-hmm. feel really in control of your life. And you know, obviously it helps if you really are at a point where you don't know where to begin, or if you need some booster sessions, if you've been in therapy for a long time, to get reacquainted with the concept of self-regulation and self-control. But objectively speaking, I don't think you absolutely need to be in a therapeutic context in order to access self-regulatory behaviors and processes and mindsets and beliefs.
What do you mean? What are you saying when you say a trauma-informed guide to fostering personal resilience and enhancing interpersonal skills? What do you mean by that?
So I am a trauma-informed therapist mm-hmm. In the sense that I think trauma can really profoundly inform or influence how individuals grow up, how they think, how they feel, how they trust, how they are attached to others, and how they interact with the world around them. So trauma-informed care is an approach that recognizes the widespread impact of trauma. And we're talking about trauma in the sense of something that's really horrific that happened in like a one-time event, right? Getting maybe sexually assaulted or having been robbed or something, or trauma in sort of the sense of everyday chronic levels of trauma, right? Being exposed to maybe domestic violence in one's home and things of that nature. But trauma that really sort of has an impact on how it is that one develops is one that I'm really concerned about. And so rather than asking, though, you know, what is wrong with you, it really sort of frames the question of what happened to you. And I think this shift really allows for more empathy, deeper connection, and better support. So when I talk about implementing trauma-informed care, I'm really thinking about ways at which the therapy alliance doesn't re-traumatize the individual. By creating a safe, you know, predictable, respectful environment for the team or, you know, whomever I'm working with. It's also about improving engagement and outcomes, right? So when people feel understood and safe, they're more likely to trust what it is that we're doing within the therapeutic alliance and that they're able to participate in really implementing some of the changes that are being recommended. And then finally, it's about building more compassionate systems and services, right? So it's about really fostering a empathetic and collaborative as well as culturally sensitive relationship and understanding the impact of institutions that have institutions on individuals, leading to more sort of humane and equitable as well as effective services. So that's sort of my take on trauma-informed care, and that's what I try to really infuse within this book.
So what I hear you saying is we are talking about ACEs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. And ACEs come from all different directions. You know, mm-hmm. It might be a physical trauma. It might be a psychological trauma. It might be just economics of, you know, the situation in which you are living, the conditions in which you are living. Mm-hmm. Have you looked at or do you have any feel for how culture impacts self-regulation?
Yeah, that's a really, I think we can have a very, very long discussion around
okay.
that.
All right.
Yeah, but in terms of ways in which, you know, our cultural capacity to really witness, right, co-understand or co-witness what mm-hmm. is happening in the world, and being able to identify it as problematic or not problematic, I think is really a part of some of the stuff we're swimming in. So for instance, we might have cultures or individuals who come from cultures who completely don't even bat an eye to corporal punishment, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And, you know, to giving your child pow-pow on the behind if they're behaving poorly or something of that nature, right?
For the listening eyes, we're not talking about severe abuse.
Not abuse.
No.
We're talking about cultures that really endorse this idea of, you know, that type of corporal redirection, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
This idea and what we have found is that individuals who come from those cultures are not going to necessarily sort of identify those experiences as traumatic. What they might say is that's what happens all the time, and
exactly.
I think I deserved it maybe for having broken every rule, you know, that my parents had put forth for me, mm-hmm. right? So I think that there is certainly sort of a place to be able to suggest that there are protective factors as well as ways in which our cultural sort of lens can dictate how it is that we interpret our experiences, so to speak. And I think that, you know, in the American culture, what we have also sort of done is really created an environment by which we think, you know, trauma has to reach a level by which, abuse has happened in order to perceive it as perceived as quote unquote bad or good. Right. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot to be said about ways in which our belief systems and as a collective can sometimes inform how it is that we're seeing pathology and experiences that are, are subject to intervention or not later on.
And it's going to influence, you know, whether they and I may be wrong, but whether they buy into the whole self-regulation, you know, mm-hmm. whether they see the need for that. You know, mm-hmm. often the parents will say, oh, that's not that bad. Mm-hmm. I went through X, Y, and Z, you right. know? And I say that because that makes a big impact on how the client proceeds.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear a lot around different emotions, particularly about anger mm-hmm. and how some cultures really are open to expression of anger, but not anything else, right? Mm-hmm. Or around mm-hmm. sadness, and sadness being something that is not allowed, right? Tears aren't allowed. But when it comes to perhaps, you know, stress, we can say, oh, we're stressed. It's just there's a lot of rules around what is allowed and not allowed in different cultural contexts that we also have to account for. And that's something that I definitely emphasize when individuals are trying to, you know, learn self-regulation skills and they are telling me, well, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, that's not something that we even consider to be problematic.
Mm-hmm. And how do you draw them in when their culture may say, oh, that's not that big a deal. Mm-hmm. You can handle it. But it is a big deal because that's why they are where they are. And that's why they, you know, handle things the way they do, and you know that is really the impetus of the behavior that they are exhibiting. I mean, you know, what do you do? I mean, I know I'm asking impossible questions probably, but you know, I just want to know, you know, if you have any tricks of the trade.
Yeah, well, I tell my clients all the time that it's not about the generation or before you. It's not about your ancestors. It's not about your neighbors or your community. It's about you, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's about really coming back to, yes, even if we are coming from a culture where anger is endorsed, but other emotions aren't, it's about how that is impacting you. And so I do a lot of, you know, motivational interview and pose the idea that if things were to get worse or to get better or to stay the same, how is it that is going to impact your life? And is that something you would like for mm-hmm. yourself, but also perhaps for your future children or for your friend or for your, your sibling, so to speak. And so I really center it around the person and how it is that they're responding to the experience. So I really encourage in terms of like common threads, I guess, of self-regulation, I encourage awareness, labeling what it is, what the thing is for what it is, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I encourage as much of perspective taking and reframing from what it is that is the old sort of guard way of thinking about their life experiences. Encourage body regulation. So like, how is it your body is feeling? Yes, you're saying it's not a big deal for me to be scolded and to be, you know, reprimanded in this way, but what is your body saying? You know, mm-hmm. is it that you're feeling sensations and tensions in your spine, in your back, in your gut, right? And I try the best I can to also improve acceptance, right? Reducing resistance. It's not about, again, what the story is that has been told to you. It's about the fact that there might be some discrepancies between how it is that you're experiencing this moment and how perhaps others might be experiencing this moment. We are also about acting and action planning, moving forward effectively, mm-hmm. right? Self-soothing, creating routines and stability. So there's so many different facets to self-regulation that really just really doesn't matter so much about what it is that others are thinking or how it is that you have been brought up. It's about the moment and where you stand right now.
What impact do you find that one's, I don't know, SES plays, their economics, you know, are the community that they live in, if it's impoverished, if it's affluent, does that impact how they respond?
I think that when it comes to emotions, yes, there is some level of privilege to being able to have and own all of one's emotions. And yes, there, you know, when we think about the hierarchy of needs, right, when one is not as well resourced, and maybe is concerned about, you know, the day-to-day survival, right? They're not really allowed and able to experience higher ordered emotions, like, you know, like just this idea that they are, you know, not meeting their life's potential, right? Or that they have the capacity to even feel more nuanced behaviors or emotions other than the basic emotions, right? And so, yes, I think economics unfortunately does play a role. And there is maybe a desire, a luxury, you know, that comes with being able to have the time and the bandwidth and the space to have bigger emotions, you know, like, yes, you know, mindfulness is something that we can all access, but it's not something we can all have at any given moment. And so when we don't have our basic needs met, it can be quite hard to, you know, sit in journals, for instance, or have a grounding moment. So I think economics certainly does play a role in our capacity to be able to have the bandwidth to be able to self-regulate, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I want you to hold your thoughts. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. It's time for Reflections with Raphael, a commentary from Raphael Hollyfield Wimmer, an honor student and gifted musician at the esteemed Girard Academic Music Program in Philadelphia, where he blends intellect with creativity. Whether he's striking keys, sounding drums, or sharing ideas, Raphael brings insight with rhythm, thought with heart, and a fresh perspective you won't want to miss, reminding us that wisdom isn't just a matter of age, it's a matter of vision.
Hey y'all, this is Raphael and you're listening to Raphael's Reflection. Today, I would like to talk about the importance of mindfulness and self-awareness, especially in this day and age. In my mind, self-awareness refers to being aware of yourself and how you come across. In my experience, at least in US popular culture, self-awareness was not really a thing that people paid attention to back in the day. It seems like farther back you go in US history, the less important and the less used self-awareness was. When I say awareness is important, I mean both awareness of others and of yourself. Like I said, in the past, people were so unaware of themselves and unaware of how their behaviors and actions impacted others that depending on what the conversation was about, lots of things that people said or opinions that they had would be found very offensive, and sometimes those people would get called out for being rude or disrespectful. Or more oftentimes than not, the people who felt hurt or disrespected did not feel comfortable telling the person that they were being offensive, which was most likely because of power dynamics or just general awkwardness. Oftentimes, even when people were offended by what someone else said, most people just took it and moved on with their day, because that's just how things worked in those times. However, in today's society, self-awareness has become so much more necessary and even crucial in many cases. People in today's society get offended really easily, both in real-life conversation and online. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing or that they don't have the right to be offended by what they're offended by, but it makes awareness of yourself and of other people extremely important. If you're not aware of yourself, it's really easy to slip up and say the wrong thing or say something in a way that sounds rude or condescending. At the same time, if you're not aware of other people or unable to read the room, this can make you an outcast in the situation. For example, if there's a group of friends mourning the loss of an elder or parent, the last thing that you would want to do is make an ill-timed joke about dead people when you walk in. On top of this, since everything in today's world is so chronically online, the majority of conversations that people have with each other are online. In my opinion, talking online makes it even harder not to offend anyone than if you were talking with them face to face, because a lot of times when you're texting or emailing someone, things can come off in the wrong tone and easily offend the other person, even if you didn't mean anything by it. All I'm trying to say with all this is, whether you're in person or online, please be careful of what you say and always be aware of yourself and others, because you never know what effect your words have on someone until it's too late. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed my reflection.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, a program for teens and parents and all kinds of folks who are interested in what is happening in the world today with Gen Z and Gen Alpha. Joining me, I welcome again Dr. Kathy Wu. She is a licensed psychologist and the author of The Self-Regulation Handbook for Teens and Young Adults, a trauma-informed guide to fostering personal resilience and enhancing interpersonal skills. Dr. Wu, I really appreciated how each chapter of your book begins with, I guess, common comments or thoughts that young people express. Why was that important to you?
It was really important for me to capture the voices of the exact people that I wanted to connect with. And these were really important snippets of stories that I have heard over and over again from my clients. And I thought that if the repetition of how it is that people are emoting, says anything, it means that a lot of people are feeling this way. So I wanted to be sure that I capture that and to really highlight the stories that oftentimes are not explicitly stated. And I thought that the language use was really important, because it really captures exactly the not just the feelings and the thoughts, but really just the ways in which people are understanding themselves in the world. And so you will see, yeah, that there's a lot of Gen Z type verbiage in there that I hope that will really give a sense of relatability and to be able to really, give that insider perspective as to what anxiety actually looks like in the ground, right? Or out in the wild, so to speak.
Will you walk the listening audience through the flow of a chapter? I mean, like, there's a chapter, there's the explanation, there's the self-reflection and strategies. And with those strategies come that, I love this, the closing with positive change and resource. I mean, I thought each chapter was just so very well done. Because,
thank you so much.
I really did. So if you don't mind, would you take some time just to walk us through that whole flow of a chapter?
Yeah, so as you have mentioned, I start off with really voices from teens and young adults today. And I take them through more of a synopsis after that of what exactly they are dealing with in each chapter. So for instance, relational abuse is one of the topics. And so I will, from a clinical perspective, describe what that looks like. So understanding what relational abuse is, what the different types of abuse might look like. Ways in which you might hear terms like what stonewalling means, or love bombing and trust bonding, and all of these different concepts that are very much in the ether and create and giving more of a sense as to the totality of that those experiences and what it is that one deals with when dealing with relational abuse. And from there, I give a clinical sort of case study of sorts, and in a gender neutral fashion, talk about what that lived experience looks like for each individual when dealing with a different type of relational abuse. And from there, we go into, well, you just heard about Skylar's story of relational abuse. Mm-hmm. How does it actually look like in your world? So I present mm-hmm. some reflective questions that really gets at sort of the impact, right? So the emotional impact, what are the different types of communication dynamics you have noticed in your life? What does isolation and control look like? And have mm-hmm. you experienced it? Behavioral patterns that you have noted or that others have noted. So really this part is where I want the reader to take pen to paper and really answer it and answer those questions in an earnest way. So it's a really reflective and interactive way by which you can then take all of the clinical stuff that we just learned about and see it through your lens of your life. And then we jump into the self-regulation strategies. And I preface each little sort of set of skills with, well, there is something to be done about this, right? And is as compassionate a way as I can possibly. And I, when writing this part, I really imagine myself in the shoes of the reader, but also bring forth all my experiences having had actually these conversations with clients. And so in a little snippet of sorts, the best I could in the time restraints and or the space restraints I had, really create a sense of opening to being able to actually apply some of the skills that follow. So for instance, I talk about ways in which we can increase open communication, what respect actually would mean if you were to implement a self-guided approach to increasing your self-respect. Talk about conflict resolution and how you can kind of check in with the difference between affection and intimacy, or how to improve and balance sort of physical affection and emotional closeness, so to speak. We also have a lot of action-oriented interventions in this section, mm-hmm. because I really do believe that in order to really be effective in making change, it's one thing to have insights, it's another to actually follow with behaviors. And so there's a lot that goes into this section to help with safety planning, you know, getting trusted individuals involved in your life, having maybe thinking about a safe place to go to if you are in an abusive relationship. And then there's also just lots of ways in which, you know, I encourage social justice and advocacy projects and things of that nature. And then after all of these different interventions that you could possibly implement for yourself, I actually force you to do so through just another final reflection in mm-hmm. which you yeah. answer questions like, what are your desires for a healthy relationship? What are the three skills that you can use right this moment? And then, of course, I end with tons of resources, you know, the National yes. Helpline and Crisis Support Center, online support and information, as well as books that I have screened myself, and each of those I have read, you know, to either front to back, or have really done my research to make sure and to screen out. So it's a really comprehensive guide, and the chapters I kind of see as maybe a workshop, but one that you can actually go back to time and time again to implement.
I totally agree. Well, we've been talking about your book. Tell us where we can access your book.
Yeah, so this book can be found at any major book outlet. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble's. You can just go online and do a quick search, and you'll see that there's a bunch of places that you can go to for it. And I think what's really important is that this book is one where you can go to time and time again. It's not something that you just read once. It's a mm-hmm. guide for a reason. And it's one where I think you you will be able to see some practical applications to at any time of your life. Yes, it's catered to teens and young adults, but I've found that parents have been really, really grateful for its for all of that it's got to offer.
Well, in these last few minutes, of course, I still have about 20 questions I want to ask you, but why do we see so much, this is just from where you sit, so much loneliness and disconnection in a hyper-connected world?
It's such a conundrum, isn't it? It's a paradox. And I think it's because we have been, sort of told that you are not lonely because you are connected, but we don't really define what connection means, what truly human connection is. And we talk about you have a, a few thousand followers on this social media account, but really it doesn't get very close to how it is that true human connection is actually something that activates the brain's reward system and reduces stress hormones. Oftentimes we have the reverse in that when we are online, we are actually more stressed than we are actually feeling rewarded.
How do young people absorb and carry collective trauma differently than adults?
That's a really good question. I think that we definitely are putting a lot on our young people. And I think just the sheer volume of things that come up, we're expected them to just integrate, internalize, and move on. And I think that just, for instance, this generation have been growing up in the time of mass shootings and such, right? So we have, one incident another after another after another. And so I think that there is just this normalization that this is something that a teen or a young person should just observe and then get over. And I think that as a result of that, young folks are just told to be braver, to, learn those drills and move on with their lives without really being able to give pause to the fact that, some of the things that we're swimming in right now are incredibly toxic. And so, yeah, I think there is definitely a disparity between how it is that we are giving room and space to being able to process and understand what is happening that I think few past generations have had the luxury to do more.
What is it that you think adults most often misunderstand about young folks' emotional struggles today?
Yeah, I think that there is certainly this insinuation that things are not as bad, that teens are they have more luxuries than they have had and that their past generations have had. I think adults are also sometimes not truly understanding that this time is different from when they grew up, And I think that is definitely a starting point, a disservice that we're doing to our generation right now. That, yeah, we were fine, so you should be fine too, but that doesn't really capture the context and how objectively different it is now.
Despite everything, when you think of all the stressors that young folks are facing, what gives you hope?
I have a child, and every time I see her, she's just taking in the world in such an open and non-judgmental way. And I think by nature of the fact that she exists, that other children and other teens and other people, wherever they are in their development, exist too. And so that just calls to me to nourish that, to continue to provide as much space and attention and compassion And so I know it's not something that everyone can relate to if they're not a parent, but just being able to see that, you know, that they're not born jaded. They're not born.
It's true.
You know, in, mm-hmm. in this very sort of defensive way, you know, that gives us, that gives me hope.
Right. Well, I think in reading the book, you know, one of the keys that came out was just recognizing, you know, that the limits of our control, that we really don't control everything. And, you know, not everything is within our power to control. And I think that that's important. But it's time out. We could talk more and more. But it's time out for 411 Team. My guest has been Dr. Kathy Wu, author of the Self-Regulation Handbook for Teens and Young Adults. Dr. Wu, thank you for your work and helping us better understand what young folks are carrying and how we can support them. Much appreciation to my listening audience for the privilege of your time and ear. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollifield. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at wfsu.org.